Hi, this is Tony Bruschi. You're about to listen to our brand new podcast, Dark Side of Wikipedia. Being a brand new show, we need to let other folks know that this thing exists so we can keep doing it. I'd greatly appreciate your help in that effort by leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, and I'm going to make it worth your while as well. We're going to give away a $200 Amazon gift certificate to one person who left us a review. All you have to do is leave that review on Apple Podcasts, take a screenshot of it, and then send it to me. Send it to review@darksideofwiki.com. So, again, to review, leave the review at Apple Podcasts, take the screenshot, and then send it to me. Review@darksideofwiki.com. That's the email address. Review@darksideofwiki.com. Very soon, I'll select one person to get that $200 Amazon gift card as a thank you for leaving that review and letting other folks know we exist. Also, be sure to share us on social media, let your friends and family know, and be sure to press that subscribe button as well as we get another great podcast off the ground. I hope you enjoy The Dark Side of Wikipedia. What do you do when your steamboat is only designed to carry 376 souls, yet you have 2,137 ticketed passengers waiting to board? A lesson in the dangers of overcrowding, a vessel came to a head on the Mississippi River in April of 1865 when the steamboat Sultana would take its final voyage. And many of the souls on board would take their final breaths.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is The Dark Side of Wikipedia.
Sultana was a Mississippi River side-wheel steamboat, which exploded on April 27th, 1865, in the worst maritime disaster in United States history. Constructed of wood in 1863 by the John Lithenberry Boatyard in Cincinnati, she was intended for the lower Mississippi cotton trade. The steamer registered 1,719 tons and normally carried a crew of 85. For 2 years, she ran a regular route between St. Louis and New Orleans and was frequently commissioned to carry troops. Although designed with a capacity of only 376 passengers, she was carrying 2,137 when three of the boat's four boilers exploded and she burned to the waterline and sank near Memphis, Tennessee. The disaster was overshadowed in the press by events surrounding the end of the American Civil War, including the killing of President Lincoln's assassin John Wilkes Booth just the day before, and no one was ever held accountable for the tragedy. This is one of those where when I saw the picture or the graphic of it, and it's, you know, I don't believe it's really a picture, it's drawn. Mm-hmm. I remember seeing it in history books, kind of, but I don't remember this ever being discussed or talked about. So, yeah, overshadowed at the time of it happening and overshadowed throughout the rest of history.
Yeah.
As well.
I've never heard of this one.
For being as horrible of a disaster as it was, it's kind of amazing.
You know what creeps me out is when they talk about people on board boats, they call them souls. Mm-hmm. Souls on board. It's almost like foreshadowing that they're not going to make it.
They do it too in airplanes, don't they?
I know. Yeah. It creeps me out.
Why is it? What is that? Why is that? Why is it not just people? Or it's very foreboding. It implies potential death.
Yeah. I don't know. I hate that.
Well, I mean, is that something that should be Mickey Moused, where it's like, oh, it's going to make people feel uncomfortable, or should it just be left as is because it also communicates to a certain extent the gravity of the responsibility to which the captain is responsible for? It's not just, you got a bunch of people. I think it does convey more
you know, more weight of souls. These are souls. These are people. These have, they have lives. They, you know, they'll haunt the shit out of your family if you kill them.
Yeah, I don't know. I think of the soul more in terms of after the person has deceased. So yeah, that's why it scares me.
It'd be interesting to know where that started or why that started or how that started.
Yeah.
It's probably like, it's probably no thought to it, really. We're overanalyzing it.
Yeah, probably.
But I don't know. Tony and Jenny Bruschi joining you for this episode of The Dark Side of Wikipedia. Steamboat Sultana is what we are talking about today. Under the command of Captain James Cass Mason of St. Louis, Sultana left St. Louis on April 13th, 1865, bound for New Orleans, Louisiana. On the morning of April 15th, she was tied up at Cairo, Illinois, when word reached the city that President Abraham Lincoln had been shot at Ford's Theater. Immediately, Captain Mason grabbed an armload of Cairo newspapers and headed south to spread the news, knowing that telegraphic communication with the South had been almost totally cut off because of the war. Upon reaching Vicksburg, Mississippi, Mason was approached by Captain Reuben Hatch, the chief quartermaster at Vicksburg. Hatch had a deal for Mason: thousands of recently released Union prisoners of war that had been held by the Confederacy at the prison camps of Cahaba near Salem, Alabama, and Andersonville in southwest Georgia had been brought to a small parole camp outside of Vicksburg to await release to the north. The U.S. government would pay $2.75 per enlisted man and $8 per officer to any steamboat captain who would take the group north. Knowing that Mason was in need of money, Hatch suggested that he could guarantee Mason a full load of about 1,400 prisoners if Mason would agree to give him a kickback. Hoping to gain much money through this deal, Mason quickly agreed to the offered bribe. Leaving Vicksburg, Sultana traveled downriver to New Orleans, continuing to spread the news of Lincoln's assassination. On April 21st, 1865, Sultana left New Orleans with about 70 cabin and deck passengers and a small amount of livestock. She also carried a crew of 85. About 10 hours south of Vicksburg, one of Sultana's four boilers sprang a leak. Under reduced pressure, the steamboat limped into Vicksburg to get the boiler repaired and to pick up her promised load of prisoners. Faulty boiler repair. When the paroled prisoners, primarily from the states of Ohio, Michigan, Indiana, Kentucky, Tennessee, and West Virginia, were brought from the parole camp to Sultana, a mechanic was brought down to work on the leaky boiler. Though the mechanic wanted to cut out and replace a ruptured steam, Mason knew that such a job would take a few days and cost him his precious load of prisoners. By the time the repairs had been completed, the prisoners would have been sent home on other boats. Instead, Mason and his chief engineer, Nathan Reitinger, convinced the mechanic to make temporary repairs, hammering back the bulged boilerplate and riveting a patch of lesser thickness over the steam. Instead of taking 2 or 3 days to temporarily repair, it took only one. During her time in port, and while the repairs were being made, Sultana took on the paroled prisoners. Although Hatch had suggested that Mason might get as many as 1,400 released Union prisoners, a mix-up with the parole camp books and suspicion of bribery from other steamboat captains caused the Union officer in charge of the loading, Captain George Augustus Williams, to place every man at the parole camp on board Sultana, believing the number to be less than 1,500. Although Sultana had a legal capacity of only 376, by the time she backed away from Vicksburg on the night of April 24, 1865, she was severely overcrowded, with 1,960 paroled prisoners, 22 guards from the 58th Ohio Volunteer Infantry, 70 paying cabin passengers, and 85 crew members, a total of 2,137 people. Many of the paroled prisoners had been weakened by their incarceration in the Confederate prison camps and associated illnesses, but had managed to gain some strength while waiting at the parole camp to be officially released. The men were packed into every available space, and the overflow was so severe that in some places the decks began to creak and sag and had to be supported with heavy wooden beams. Sultana spent 2 days traveling upriver, fighting against one of the worst spring floods in the river's history. In some places, the river overflowed the banks and spread out 3 miles wide. Trees along the riverbank were almost completely covered, until only the very tops of the trees were visible above the swirling, powerful water. On April 26, Sultana stopped in Helena, Arkansas, where photographer Thomas W. Banks took a picture of the grossly overcrowded vessel. Near 7 p.m., Sultana reached Memphis, Tennessee, and the crew began unloading 120 tons of sugar from the hold. Near midnight, Sultana left Memphis, perhaps leaving behind about 200 men. She then went a short distance upriver to take a new load of coal from some coal barges, and then at about 1 a.m. started north again. So that's how that fun ship cruise began.
Can you imagine these men were literal survivors of hell.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those Confederate prison camps, I mean, they've made movies about them because they were just so, so ridiculously terrible, you know, and the men coming out of there were basically just walking skeletons.
Yeah.
And they've made it, and they think they're on their boat heading home.
No matter how shitty and uncomfortable that boat is, it looks a hell of a lot better where they came from.
Well, it's better than Andersonville, so they're ready to get on it and get home.
Yeah.
Only to have this happen.
Yeah. What is interesting to me is there is paying passengers on the boat as well. It's like, we're already overcrowded, and who wants to take a cruise?
Yeah.
That's interesting. And then they're still doing cargo and everything. Was there just no sense at the time for weight or what stress could be put onto a vessel? I mean, I guess steamboat technology was, you know, modern of the time, right? So maybe there just wasn't experience?
I don't know. I guess they, you know, they loaded her until she got too low in the water.
Wow. I guess it's kind of one of those things where anybody today, it's easy from, you know, all this distance to be saying, well, why didn't you think of this or that? Like, well, that's why we think of this or that now.
Well, and it doesn't sound like it's so much that it just sank because of weight. It sank because of the pressure of putting all those boilers under, you know, that much strain.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I'm saying is nobody considered these things at the moment or thought, well, we'll push through it. It's amazing. Continue on. Near 2 a.m. on April 27th, 1865, when Sultana was just 7 miles north of Memphis, its boilers suddenly exploded. First one boiler exploded, followed by a split second later by two more. The cause of the explosion is unknown. One theory suggests the initial explosion was the result of too much pressure and low water in the boilers. There was reason to believe allowable working steam pressure had been exceeded in an attempt to overcome the Spring River current. Also, Sultana's tubular boilers were made of charcoal hammered, number one, a poor choice since the metal tended to crack and get brittle when heated and cooled repeatedly. Another theory suggests the explosion was the result of a deliberate act by a Confederate agent named Robert Loudon. On May 8, 1888, the Memphis Daily Appeal newspaper published an article claiming Loudon, alias Charles Dale, had planted a lump of coal that contained a bomb on the coal pipe in front of the boilers. The Confederate Secret Service had developed bombs disguised as coal, known as country torpedoes, for use in maritime attacks during the Civil War. The enormous explosion of steam came from the top rear of the boilers and went upward at a 45-degree angle, tearing through the crowded decks above and completely demolishing the pilot house. Without a pilot to steer the boat, Sultana became a drifting, burning hulk. The terrific explosion flung some of the deck passengers into the water and destroyed a large section of the boat. The twin smokestacks toppled over, the left-hand one backwards into the blasted hole, and the right-hand one forward onto the crowded forward section of the upper deck. The forward part of the upper decks collapsed into the exposed furnace boxes, shoving kindling into the open fire boxes, which soon caught fire and turned the remaining superstructure into an inferno. Survivors of the explosion panicked and raced for the safety of the water, but in their weakened condition soon ran out of strength and began to cling to each other. Whole groups went down together. While this fight for survival was taking place, the southbound steamer Bostonia, built in 1860, but coming downriver in her maiden voyage after being refurbished, arrived at 3 a.m., an hour after the explosion, and arrived at the site of the burning wreck to rescue scores of survivors. At the same time, dozens of people began to float past the Memphis waterfront, calling for help until they were noticed by the crews of docked steamboats and U.S. warships, who immediately set about rescuing the half-drowned victims. Eventually, the hulk of Sultana drifted about 6 miles to the west bank of the river and sank at around 9 a.m. near Mound City in present-day Marion, Arkansas, about 7 hours after the explosion. Other vessels joined the rescue, including the steamers Silver Spray, Jenny Lind, and Pocahontas, the Navy ironclad Essex, and the sidewheel gunboat USS Tyler. Passengers who survived the initial explosion had to risk their lives in the icy spring runoff of the Mississippi or burn with the boat. Many died of drowning or hypothermia. Some survivors were plucked from the tops of semi-submerged trees along the Arkansas shore. Bodies of victims continued to be found downriver for months, some as far as Vicksburg. Many bodies were never recovered. Most of Sultana's officers, including Captain Mason, were among those who perished. The exact death toll is unknown, although the most recent evidence indicates 1,168. On May 19, 1865, less than a month after the disaster, Brigadier General William Hoffman, Commissary General of Prisoners, who investigated the disaster, reported an overall loss of soldiers, passengers, and crew of 1,238. In February of 1867, the Bureau of Military Justice placed the death toll at 1,100. In 1880, the 51st Congress of the United States, in conjunction with the War Department, Pensions and Records Department, reported the loss of life aboard the Sultana as 1,259. The official count by the United States Customs Service was 1,547. In 1880, the War Department, Pensions and Records Department placed the number of survivors at 931, but the most recent research places the number at 969. Many of the dead were interred at the Memphis National Cemetery. Three victims of the wreck of Sultana are interred at Elmwood Cemetery in Memphis, Tennessee. About 760 survivors were transported to hospitals in Memphis. Fortunately, since Memphis had been captured by federal forces in 1862 and turned into a supply and recuperation city, there were numerous hospitals in the city with the latest medical equipment and trained personnel. Of the roughly 760 people taken to Memphis hospitals, there were only 31 deaths between April 28th and June 28th. Newspaper accounts indicate that the people of Memphis had sympathy for the victims, although they were in an occupied city. The Chicago Opera Troupe, a minstrel group that had traveled upriver on Sultana before getting off at Memphis, staged a benefit, while the crew of the gunboat Essex raised $1,000. In December of 1885, the survivors living in the northern states of Indiana, Michigan, and Ohio began attending annual reunions, forming the National Sultana Survivors Association. Eventually, the group settled on meeting in the Toledo, Ohio area, perhaps inspired by their northern comrades. A southern group of survivors, men from Kentucky and Tennessee, began meeting in 1889 around Knoxville, Tennessee. Both groups met as close to the April 27th anniversary date as possible, corresponded with each other, and shared the title National Sultana Survivors Association. By the mid-1920s, only a handful of survivors were able to attend the reunions. In 1929, only two men attended the Southern reunion. The next year, only one man showed up. The last Northern survivor, Private Jordan Barr of the 15th Michigan Volunteer Infantry Regiment, died on May 16, 1938, at the age of 93. The last of the Southern survivors and last overall survivor was Private Charles M. Eldridge of the 3rd Tennessee Cavalry, who died at his home at age 96 on September 8, 1941, more than 76 years after the Sultana disaster. So I guess don't go up looking up for the Facebook group of the survivors anymore, because it's probably
It kind of surprises me how early the, not early in reference to when this happened, but that sounds like one of the first kind of survivor groups formed from a disaster. I mean, most...
Like formal survivor groups?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you don't hear about that very often from anything that far back.
Yeah.
You know, that's more of a almost, you know, 20th century kind of thing.
Sure. Sure. It's interesting. I don't know. I mean, obviously it's good because I'm sure a lot of people that were involved in it got something out of it and felt, you know, something. I don't know that I could do it.
No.
I don't know that I would be good in a group. Like, I'm not good in a group normally.
No.
But I don't know that I would be good in a survivor group. I'm sure that there's very therapeutic for many people, but I think it would be like, I wouldn't be like reclusive, like not wanting to like remember that it happened or like trying to block it up, but I don't know that I'd want it every year. Let's all get together thing. You know, that's me personally though.
The only reference I have is my grandfather was a Pearl Harbor survivor. Mm-hmm. And I don't think he went back once when he was very old, you know, when his days were numbered, just to go back once. But I don't think he met with others that were survivors, you know, and of course, you know, they're spread throughout the country, but still, I don't think he ever attended any Pearl Harbor survivor groups or anything like that. I think that was something that was just too painful. And I would imagine similar type of feeling with this.
It just probably all depends how your personality is and how you cope with that.
Yeah.
For some, the group setting is what works.
Sure.
For others, it's like, I'm good.
Yeah.
You know, whether you are or not. But group doesn't necessarily works for everybody. But that would be it's interesting just to think about what that must have been like, you know, after the fact, and then trying to, I don't know. I mean, how do you pick up and just kind of keep going after dealing with that one?
I think the hardest part for me, if I had been involved with that, would be to know whether or not it was on purpose.
Yeah.
Whether or not it was, you know, somebody still angry about the war, which had just ended literally days before, or if it were just gross, you know, negligence with the whole boat being overloaded and the boilers being under too much pressure.
Trying to find justice and figure out justice or an answer.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why did this happen? Yeah, exactly. Let's continue on with the story. The official cause of the Sultana disaster was determined to be mismanagement of water levels in the boilers, exacerbated by the fact that the vessel was severely overcrowded and top-heavy. As the steamboat made her way north following the twists and turns of the river, she listed severely to one side, then to the other. Her four boilers were interconnected and mounted side by side so that if the boat tipped sideways, water would tend to run out of the highest boiler. With the fire still going against the empty boiler, this created hot spots. When the boiler tipped the other way, water rushing back into the empty boiler would hit the hot spots and flash instantly to steam, creating a sudden surge in pressure. This effect of careening could have been minimized by maintaining high water levels in the boilers. The official inquiry found that the boat's boilers exploded due to the combined effects of careening, low water level, and a faulty repair to a leaky boiler made a few days earlier. The most recent investigation into the cause of the disaster by Pat Jennings, principal engineer of Hartford Steam Boiler Inspection, an insurance company which came into existence in 1866 because of the Sultana explosion, has determined that three main factors led to the explosion. One, the type of metal used in the construction of the boilers. Charcoal hammered number one, which tends to become brittle with prolonged heating and cooling. Charcoal hammered number one was no longer used for the manufacture of boilers after 1879. The use of the dirty Mississippi River water to feed the boilers. The dirt tended to settle on the bottom of the boilers or clog between the flues that leave hot spots. And the design of the boilers. Sultana had tubular boilers filled with 24 horizontal 5-inch flues. Being so closely packed within the 48-inch diameter, boilers tend to cause the muddy sediment to form hot pockets. They were extremely difficult to clean. Tubular boilers were pulled from use on steamboats plying the lower Mississippi after two more steamboats with tubular boilers exploded shortly after Sultana. An episode of History Detectives that aired on July 2nd, 2014, reviewed the known evidence, thoroughly disputing the sabotage theory, and then focused on the question of why the steamboat was allowed to be crowded to several times its normal capacity before departure. The report blamed Quartermaster Hatch, an individual with a long history of corruption and incompetence who was able to keep his job due to political connections. He was the young brother of Illinois politician Ozias M. Hatch, an advisor and close friend of President Lincoln. Throughout the war, Reuben Hatch had shown incompetence as a quartermaster and competence as a thief, bilking the government out of thousands of dollars. Although brought up on court-martial charges, Hatch managed to get letters of recommendation from such noted authorities as President Abraham Lincoln and General of the Army Ulysses S. Grant. The letters reside in the National Archives in Washington, D.C. After the disaster, Hatch refused three separate subpoenas to appear before Captain Speed's trial and give testimony. Hatch died in 1871, having escaped justice due to his numerous highly placed patrons, including two presidents. Many alternative theories also exist. In 1888, a St. Louis resident named William Streeter claimed that his former business partner, Robert Loudon, made a confession while they were drinking in a saloon of having sabotaged Sultana by a coal torpedo. Loudon, a former Confederate agent and saboteur who operated and around St. Louis, had been responsible for the burning of the steamboat Ruth. Thomas Edgeworth, the inventor of the coal torpedo, was a former resident of St. Louis and was involved in similar acts of sabotage against Union shipping interests. However, his great-great-grandson, Joseph Thatcher, who wrote the book on Thomas and the coal torpedo, denies that a coal torpedo was used. If you read my book, you'll note that we do not claim the Sultana, nor did he. Still, supporting Loudon's claim was the fact that what appeared to be a piece of artillery shell was recovered from the sunken wreck. Loudon's claim is controversial, however, and most scholars support the official explanation. The location of the explosion from the top rear of the boilers, far away from the fireboxes, tends to indicate that Loudon's claim of sabotage of an exploding coal torpedo in the firebox was pure bravado. 2 years before William Streeter's claim that Loudon sabotaged Sultana, it was a claim that Second Lieutenant James Worthington Barrett of Kentucky, an ex-prisoner and passenger on the steamboat, had caused the explosion. Barrett was a veteran of the war with Mexico and had fought bravely with his regiment until captured in Franklin, Tennessee. He was injured on the Sultana and was honorably discharged in May of 1865. There's no reason for him to have blown up the boat, especially with himself on board. Then in 1903, another person came out with a report that the Sultana had been sabotaged by a Tennessee farmer who lived along the river and cut wood for passing steamboats. After a few Union gunboats filled up their bunkers but refused to pay, the farmer supposedly hollowed out a log, filled it with gunpowder, and then left the lethal log on his woodpile. As stated in the 1903 newspaper article, the log was mistakenly taken to the Sultana. Unfortunately for the story, the Sultana was a coal-burning boat, not a wood-burner. Lack of accountability. In spite of the magnitude of the disaster, no one was ever held accountable. Captain Frederick Speed, a Union officer who sent the 1,960 paroled prisoners into Vicksburg from the parole camp, was charged with grossly overcrowding Sultana and found guilty. However, the guilty verdict was overturned by the Judge Advocate General of the Army on grounds that Speed had been at the parole camp all day and had never placed one single soldier on board the Sultana. Captain Williams, who had placed the men on board, was a regular Army officer and 1852 graduate of West Point, so the military refused to go after one of their own. And Captain Hatch, who had concocted a bribe with Captain Mason to crowd as many men onto the Sultana as possible, had quickly quit the service and was now a civilian, no longer accountable to a military court. The master of the Sultana, Captain Mason, who was ultimately responsible for dangerously overloading his vessel and ordering the faulty repairs to her leaky boiler, had died in the explosion. In the end, no one was ever held accountable for the greatest maritime disaster in the history of the United States.
I think that lack of closure, you know, nothing ever came of it. No laws were changed, no rules, no maritime rules, nothing, you know, because nobody was ever held accountable. So it was destined for this type of accident to happen again, which, you know, we know did. But it's just, I think everybody deserves to have that closure to know what happened.
Is it enough? Did they get enough closure, though? I mean, all the signs point to this was really gross mismanagement by the captain and the bribing that was going on. I mean, some of the answers are there, but they were never actually held accountable because he died.
Yeah.
And then the other ones were, you know, kind of, you know, let go on it. So do you feel like those folks had enough closure?
I don't know.
Or was there still too many questions left up in the air with all these other people making claims?
That's what's hard. Yeah. I don't know.
This is interesting. In 1982, a local archaeological expedition led by Memphis attorney Jerry O. Potter uncovered what he believed to be the wreckage of Sultana. Blackened wooden deck planks and timbers were found about 32 feet under a soybean field on the Arkansas side, about 4 miles from Memphis. The Mississippi River has changed course several times since the disaster, leaving the wreck under dry land and far from today's river. The main channel now flows about 2 miles east of its 1865 position. Wow.
That's how the Steamboat Arabia was found in the middle of a field.
Really?
Yeah. That's a museum I still want to take you to in Kansas City.
That's a Kansas City one.
I hate museums. I'll just say it. I'm one of those people that's like so bored, but that is the only museum I've ever truly, truly enjoyed. And I really want to take you there because it's just fascinating. And it's one of those things where everything they found was in such good shape. It's the largest collection of pre-Civil War items together. But the only thing that died on it was a mule. So it's like the perfect shipwreck, you know? Yeah. They have all the stuff, but nobody was sad and, you know.
No souls on board.
No, but they because the river changed, they found it in the middle of a field.
Yeah. That's interesting. I mean, I know that the river changes, but my God, it changed like by a 2 mile stretch.
Yeah.
That's scary to think. I mean, there's all these towns along the Mississippi River. I mean, so could it like still do that? I suppose it could.
Well, but you would think cities though, like think of like St. Louis. I mean, they have, you know, they have these walls and levees and things to prevent it from changing there.
There. Okay.
Farm field and stuff is more so where it's going to change because of flooding and then receding, and it didn't recede where it was.
There's some areas along the Mississippi where we travel sometimes when we go to that part of the country where it's like, holy shit, like the river's kind of over here and it's kind of over there and the bridges look remotely questionable at best. So I that's just interesting. I mean, as it floods, that's how it shifts, right? Wow. When you think of those things, you think of like rivers changing, you think, oh, that's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. This thing, you know, about 100 years, it changed by 2 miles. I guess I didn't realize that the rivers did that. Maybe that's me being dumb on geography, but
I didn't realize they changed that quickly, but you've got to think about how many massive floods there have been on the Mississippi, that's got to speed up the process of changing its course, you know, just the swelling and receding.
Makes you want to buy some land along the Mississippi and look for steamboat disasters.
No.
It's like, hey, look, we found the wreckage of a ship. It's just amazing. There you go. That's the Steamboat Sultana on today's episode of The Dark Side of Wikipedia. If you like our program, please press subscribe, whatever platform it is you're listening to us on. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts.
And if you send me a screenshot of that, send it to review@darksideofwiki. You'll be entered to a drawing for a $200 Amazon gift card. We'll be picking that winner shortly. That's how you can support our program right now and let other folks know that we exist. Send it to review@darksideofwiki.com once you leave that review on Apple Podcasts. Until next time, for Jenny, I'm Tony. Thanks for listening to The Dark Side of Wikipedia.